It's a trickling down effect, and I encourage people to really go out there and connect with different groups, different demographics that you're not a part of, and really just challenging the ideas and the messages that they've been given, and, you know, really try to understand a person for who they are and what they bring to the table, and working to eliminate those stigmas, because you do find a lot of beauty when you just learn to take off those glasses, in a sense, you know, that they've put on us to some extent. So I think I always encourage people to go out there and just meet someone new, and I don't know, you might learn a lot and be able to share skills with one another.
Thank you very much. We're here in Richgrove, California, and the Farm Worker March to Sacramento, pilgrimage essentially to Sacramento, and the workers have taken off, and it was 94 degrees last night at 3 a.m. Thank you so much, Esmeralda, for talking to us about why you're here today, helping out and being here to see the farm workers off on their pilgrimage on day two. For KPFA, I'm Sarah Blanco.
Wraps it up for another episode of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. Special thanks to producer and engineer Rod Akil. For previous episodes, go to kpfa.org or flashpoints.net. For questions or comments, email dennis@kpfa.org. Thank you for listening.
This is KBOO, Portland, Oregon.
Now I'm a farmer, and I'm digging, 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 digging. Now I'm a farmer, and I'm digging, 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 digging.
Good morning. This is Glenn Andreessen here beside you now until 12 noon. And with me in our remote recording studio is Jim Gilbert.
Good morning, Glenn.
Who actually owns this recording studio.
Yeah, and it's a nice little spot.
It is isolated and pretty soundproof.
Yeah.
But the person who makes this all happen is our ace engineer, Joe Wilson of Bergman Productions. And we appreciate all you've done for us through the years and are continuing to do.
And I have to say, I really thank you guys for both coming out to the nursery to do this recording, because it saves me driving all the way to Portland.
Well, happy to do it. We've got a full show today, as usual. We'll start with our plant of the month. We haven't covered this one for a while. It's been more than 5 years since we've talked about walnuts.
Yeah, walnuts. Well, when I thought about walnuts and talking about them, I have some planted here, it's become a number of years ago, back in like before 1973 or thereabouts, walnuts were a somewhat major crop here in the Walnut mm-hmm. Valley. Franquette was a French variety that was grown really widely, walnuts were sold, you know, I mean, there's walnut drying places, and they sold them all over the country, and Oregon was a source of walnuts. And then we had a big frost, a severe frost, and about, I think I say it was around sometime early 70s, and sadly, the Franquette walnut was not hardy. And many of them died.
And so they didn't get replaced then with a hardier variety?
In the meantime, California was pursuing a walnut industry. And they kind of got into the market and were, I wouldn't say flooding the market, but certainly filling the demand with their plant, different varieties and different nuts and so forth. And there wasn't a good reason to replant walnut orchards. The industry kind of just fell away. And it's really too bad. I mean, that happened. The same thing happened with plums, which were dried for prunes for many, many, many years, and no longer is happening.
Yeah.
So, but we can still grow walnuts at home. They're wonderful nut to eat, and we haven't had a freeze of the degree that we had. Yeah. If you could still plant Frankette if you want, and probably get pretty sure, 50 plus years before we're anything near. I think it might have gotten down to around minus 10 some regions. That's why they died. But there were also other varieties sort of on the horizon at that time. Spurgeon was one of them. Spurgeon. And some others, and there's some other ones from different parts of the world that are hardier, but the Spurgeon type, actually Frankette, is similar. They're the ones that bear the large nuts and large quantities of them, and pretty darn easy to grow. Really, they're just, you don't have to really do much pruning, and they do get big. So if you have a compact yard, they might not be a good fit for you.
Yeah, I see lots in the city. Street trees, even, yeah. I don't think they would allow that now. But there's lots of them, and I don't know how many nuts the homeowners are actually able to harvest due to the squirrels getting there first. But
yeah, that's another thing to talk about, isn't it? I have this idea. Our squirrels out here, they get harassed by animals, wild and domestic. But in the city, I think they get more free reign and. My thought, I would love to hear somebody try this on a tree that's isolated from other trees, so squirrels can't jump from one tree to it, and then put a 2 or 2.5 or 3 foot strip piece of sheet metal around the base.
Yeah, I've done that on grapes for possums.
Uh huh.
You can. Can you picture a possum jumping? No.
No.
So they have to climb. And so I had possums eating my grapes. This was a couple decades ago, but haven't had a problem since. I mean, I don't use the metal flashing, just so they can't get a hold on it.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's interesting, too. I mean, and, there are flying squirrels, but they're not self-propelled.
No.
I don't know if they even live around,
No.
They're gliding. They should maybe be called gliding squirrels.
They go down, downhill.
They're kind of interesting, but yeah. So the main problem with growing walnuts was a husk worm that would get into the skin of it. And a good friend who sadly has passed away, Glenn Mills in Newburgh,
I think we had him on the dirt bag.
Did we?
Some years ago, yeah.
Wow. My memory's shot. I don't remember that, but that's cool. Well, Glenn grew organic walnuts, and I don't know what's happened to his orchard, but he discovered that by using a material called kaolin, which is kind of powdery. What is it, Glenn?
Clay.
Clay.
Yeah.
A powder. It's a clay material, and you'd spray that on, and the tree would look kind of weird because it'd be kind of grayish white.
Ghostly.
Yeah, ghostly. But those little bugs wouldn't get into the worm, into the husks, and he had a nice crop of organic walnuts. That way.
That's still used for apples. Apple growers, or homeowners anyway, home growers.
Yeah.
We use it, I don't know about commercial.
Yeah. It's a pretty pretty safe material. And,
indeed.
And it works good. So, anyway, I think walnuts definitely have a role in Oregon, and just keep in mind that you need some space for them.
Yeah.
They're going to get to be 40 feet in diameter at full size.
Yeah.
So,
these days, that's more than one lot.
Yeah, right. I mean, we should encourage park planting. The city park should have walnuts, and think of, produce all that food, and then the city could buy the sheet metal to keep the squirrels from
climbing
up.
Yeah, they're right there in the middle.
Exactly.
Okay, that's our plant of the month, walnuts.
Yeah. Someday I'd like to hear from listeners and see people who are growing walnuts and how they're doing for them. That would be nice to hear.
Yeah. So. Unfortunately, since this is a pre-recorded show, we don't, our phone lines aren't active. But if you do have a burning question that you need or would like answered before our September show, you can send us an email. thedirtbag@kboo.org.
And Glenn, since you mentioned that about being pre-recorded, I think you should tell the listeners why it's pre-recorded and encourage them, invite them to come to the event.
This is the reason that we're recording early, is because I will be gone in the first, essentially, the second week of August when the show runs, for our very last Scandinavian Festival booth. My brother and I have done this for 43 years. Actually, this will be our 43rd year. And it's time. It just takes up a bunch of chunk of time there in the summer.
Tell us what the festival is and what's the
outlook. Well, Scandinavian Festival. It was started in 1961 to essentially put Junction City, get some travelers going through Junction City again, if you will, because when I-5 opened up, the traffic, most of the through traffic used I-5, of course, and not the 99E or W, which goes through the Willamette Valley. And they come together in Junction City, although that's not why Junction City is called Junction City. It was destined, or they'd hoped, to be the Chicago of the West, a big rail yard there. And of course, that never happened, and it's more in Eugene, but still, it's not Chicago of the West. Eugene isn't.
Yeah, and Junction City is basically between Eugene and Corvallis, right?
That's right.
And a beautiful, nice drive down the Willamette Valley, where you can see, by the way, all of the farmland that we have preserved and saved for Oregonians over the years.
Well, this reminds me that to tie the two together here of our plant of the month and Junction City, where I grew up. I worked on a old truck farm, if you will, call it that, in high school and before, and during the summers, starting out moving pipe, but then moved up to driving tractor and harvesting whatnot. And they, I don't know how many different crops they grew, maybe a dozen, from peppermint for oil, sugar beets, seed, regular beets, green beans, bush beans, corn, hay, maybe some other things, but they also had some filberts. And a couple, 5 years or so ago, my brother and I, when we were down there for the festival, and we both worked on this farm, Harper Farms, the matriarch was still alive. And she died within a year after we were able to visit her that one time. She was, I think she died at 95 or something. But she informed us that virtually 100% of their crops now were, you want to take a guess what it is, Jim?
Grass seed?
No. No. All right. Filberts.
Oh.
Or hazelnuts.
Yep.
And you'll see a lot more of that in the Willamette Valley, where there used to be berries or something. Now there's, it just astounds me. They're planted with GPS on the tractors, I'm sure. And no matter what, how you look at the row as you're going by, it's symmetrical.
It is interesting. I'm certainly just in right here around where we live, South Clackamas County. There's hundreds of acres of hazelnuts, filberts growing around here. And I think, for a couple of there's some good reasons for people doing it. One thing, our climate in Oregon is excellent for that particular crop, better than California and just about anywhere else in the country. And it's also less labor than some of these other crops.
Yeah.
And labor right now is a big deal.
Well, and I'm sure there's a good return on it, even though it takes some number of years for a tree to start producing.
Yeah, and we've talked about some of the fun things. I think it was Garden Stumper was talking about them, when do they bloom, and all that interesting plant, the hazelnut.
Yeah.
So that was neat, Glenn. I didn't know that about your history, that you lived in Junction City, grew up in Junction City.
Yep.
Wow. Cool.
Yeah, well, this is why I became involved with the Scandinavian Festival. Growing up there, you always ask Mom, why doesn't anybody sell Swedish pancakes? I mean, they'd kind of try to do it, an organization would have a Swedish pancake feed dinner one of the nights. It's four nights. This year it's, I think it's August 12th through the 15th. If that's a Thursday through Sunday.
And the hours are approximately?
Oh, 10 to 10.
10 to 10, yeah.
Yeah.
And what do you put in? What do you put in your pancakes?
Well, we put either, there's four choices, wild blackberries that we pick that week and make into a sauce, strawberries, hood strawberries that I've already processed. We buy lingonberries and have those in a sauce, or traditional, which my Swedish American grandmother always had, nothing but butter and sugar. So that's the traditional.
Well, I'll take the three berries myself.
Some people cool. do order one of each.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Boy, yeah. Well, Joe and I are planning on coming.
Oh, great.
And, okay. And I think we're going to come on Thursday. Yes, which is the 11th, I think.
Oh, is it the 11th?
Yeah.
Okay, so sure. it's not 12th through the 15th. It must be the 11th through the 14th. Let's see, what day is the dirt bag is on the 10th?
Yep.
So yes, you're right. So it's 11th through the 14th.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, we're going to be there. So,
anyway. So we're the only ones that have Swedish pancakes. So anyway, I guess I didn't finish my story. There wasn't a real Swedish pancake booth at the festival. And so finally in 1979, my brother Gordon and I, plus a childhood friend who was Danish, his mother was from the Denmark-owned Faroese Islands. And at his house, they always called them Danish pancakes growing up. And he stuck to his guns, and he didn't want to call them Swedish pancakes. So we in the first year, we ended up calling them Nordic pancakes. But then we were always explaining, well, it's a Nordic pancake. Well, it's a Swedish pancake. So by the second year, he saw the light, and we gave up. Yeah, right. Because everybody knows them. A thin pancake without no leavening. And very traditional for all the Scandinavian countries, and probably most Western and even Eastern European countries have something.
So I years ago, I used to make a pancake that sounds like what you're making, but the recipe was pretty darn simple, as I recall. But I might have it wrong. Was like was it a cup of milk, a cup of flour, and what else? Well, anyway, do you know what your recipe is?
Well, the batches that we make, we use 8 dozen eggs and 3 gallons of milk. So
9 eggs, a cup of milk and a cup of flour. That was the recipe I learned.
Well, it's similar. I mean, like I said, everybody has their own recipe, but sure. People have, our customers want to know the recipe or what the secret is to getting those pancakes turned.
Well, this inspires me because I'm going to have grandkids visiting soon. I might try to make some Swedish pancakes for them.
Okay.
Yeah. Cool.
All right. Well, so anyway, thank you, Jim. That's why we're recording this show early.
I think that's awesome.
Okay.
See you on Thursday.
Thursday the 11th. Yeah. Yep. Right. Okay. Well, let's take our first musical break here, and then we'll come back with harvesting, because it's getting to be time. Figs, probably already harvesting some figs, apples, and pears. We'll do that. Our musical selections today all have to do with how dang hot it's been. And I thought about, well, what do we always say when it's hot? Well, you can cook an egg on the sidewalk. I didn't find any egg songs that had anything to do with that, but it kind of has something to do with cooking. So all of our tunes here. And we'll start out with Tom Principato, organ player, I think, called Fish Fry. Maybe that would work. Can you cook a fish on the sidewalk?
Maybe in Uzbekistan.
All right.
We'll be rocking. was on the main step, hanging out, just me and him. Got a little hungry, wanna get something to eat, so we went to our house on Rampart Street. It was rocking.
He's got a groove going there. Yeah. Tom Pricciapato from the album Raising the Roof.
Before we leave the Scandinavian Festival, I was just thinking also that it would be really great if any listeners go there and be sure to identify themselves and say hi at your booth, because that would be really fun.
It's likely that I'll be there.
Yeah, sounds like it. If just you and your brother are doing it. It's
well, we have... Sometimes we have up to five people working in the booth.
Yeah,
I mean us included. But
you know, there's another Scandinavian festival in Astoria.
Yes.
And last weekend I was there, and it wasn't the festival weekend, but they have a new park there dedicated to the Scandinavians that settled that region. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, that would have been my great grandfather.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, he emigrated in the 1880s.
Mm-hmm. From Sweden. Cool.
And then, so my grandmother was born in 1909. I can't remember exactly. Was she born in Astoria? Probably. My dad was.
Yeah.
Right. Lived there all through high school.
Yeah. It's a cool place. I mean, you know, so yeah. Anyway, Scandinavian.
Okay. Well, hey, we got a gardening show, right?
Oh, that's no, right. Right. That's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, fruit is coming on here, and August is prime time for at least the desert king fig.
By the time this show airs, there should be ripe desert king figs on people's trees, and it's a treat to just be so thrilled about and to celebrate, because you know, here we are in Oregon in 45 degree latitude, and most figs are grown in places like Italy and Spain and in much lower latitudes and in much warmer climates, but darn desert king and for darn really good variety. And and it bears only in our climate only one crop. Some figs will bear two. Other ones, the ones that bear two, have more difficulty ripening the fall crop because it's just oftentimes gets cold and
fall,
wet,
right?
In the fall. So, but the Desert King fig is an excellent one. But anyway, whatever kind of fig you've got, you may have another variety that's producing a braba crop, which is what those are called, the first on the old wood. And the thing to be aware of is that like figs, like apricots, they don't ripen off the tree. Mm-hmm. So you've got to pick them ripe, which makes them hard to ship. And that's why the ones you buy in stores, typically from California, are not, I mean, they're okay, but they're not the best because they have to pick them firm.
Right.
So when you take a look at your fig on the tree and it's sticking straight out from the branch, don't pick it.
And if it's still dark green, if we're talking Desert King here,
right?
If it's still dark green,
no, don't pick it. But it will. But when it starts to droop, then you're getting mm-hmm. close, and you can feel it, and you know, the saliva can start flowing. And he's like, oh man, pretty soon I'm going to be able to pick that fig, and then the birds will come and eat it. Oh, sorry, actually, we've had not too big a problem with birds in the last couple of years, so which is good.
Yeah, I still have problems with squirrels.
Yeah.
But one year I had the starlings got the whole crop. But I haven't had any problems with that except that one year.
Oh, really? Interesting. Yeah. They're down here eating the blueberries, I think, my neighbor's blueberries. But anyway, when it gets really droopy and nice and soft, that's when it's right to pick.
And it'll start turning a lighter green and even mm-hmm. a pale yellow. And, you know, you can just, there's so many usually. Just yeah. eat one and see if it's how you like it.
Yeah. If it gets too soft, you'll tell. I mean, it'll start sort of almost like falling apart. And then eventually even ants will be attracted to it.
And it'll ferment. Yeah. I've bitten into you know, figs that have that.
Yeah. So. But you know, that it's important. I mean, to really enjoy the fig, I strongly believe you should make sure it's really good and ripe. You know, like Glenn says, check it out. If you want to eat the one that's sticking straight off the tree, try it. You know, but I don't think you'll like it.
And that leads us into apples too, because apples also don't ripen off the tree. So you got to leave them on until they're how you like them.
Yep.
And the best way, if you don't have is there a brixometer or a...
Oh, yeah. There's ways to measure bricks, get the juice and stuff, but that's not... People aren't going to do that.
No, but you can just bite into one and see.
Yeah, and the general rule with those kind of tree fruits is that, you know, the fruit comes off the tree easily. Mm-hmm. If you got to yank on it, it's not going to be ripe.
And we will compare and contrast apples and pears here, in that pears do ripen off the tree, and in fact, they should be harvested when they are unripe, because you have better texture and flavor.
That's right. That's right. Like Bartlett is a really good example of that. As you were, and we should clarify, we're talking about European pears.
Yes,
because Asian pears actually don't ripen off the tree.
Yeah, we've talked about this.
We have
made lists of what ripens on the tree and off, and so Asian pears, like apples, do not ripen after you pick them. And I would also say that the same with blueberries.
That's true.
They don't ripen more. They might soften, but they're not going to ripen anymore.
That's right. So, and in fact, sitting in front of us is a plate of blueberries
that we have been snacking on.
Organic Dukes from my neighbor. And they're now the Duke variety, which we're talking and making this show on, was it July 25th?
Yeah,
they're right at their end of their season, and they're their best, sweetest, and really good.
Yeah,
good,
you know, once a blueberry turns blue, it's not ripe.
Right,
it needs really another 7 to 10 days before it's at its peak ripeness, and it's hard to tell.
Yep. Yeah, and they I'm not sure how they gauge ripeness from this commercial orchard, but these were picked with a machine, which is these days pretty common because, again, labor issues. So there's a few stems and thing, green berries in there, but darn good.
As listeners, I'm sure, know by now, I keep bees, and I, for 20 plus years, I've rented 10 of my hives to a blueberry farmer. Mm-hmm. And they will begin their U picks. That's all they do now. They just have 5 acres. They did have a picker, but it was just too much hassle. And the U picks are kind of a hassle too, but it's because they'll get a lot of people. I asked the old farmer, who's since passed away, and now his daughter has taken over the farm, which is nice, that how many, well, they always send out a postcard to their friends and family, and we get to come a day before they open it for U-picks. And even still, there's 100 people out there, maybe more.
Wow.
But I asked the farmer one time how many cars he expected the next day. And he said about 1,000. Parking is an issue.
Yeah,
for
yeah,
him.
Yeah.
So, sure. And this is just out in the country and boring.
Wow.
But anyway, so those are just some fruits there. So pears, even though they should be harvested when they're unripe, you still don't want to have to yank them off the tree, like Jim mentioned. They should come off gently. If you hold one in the cradle, one in your hand, and then just lift up on it, it should separate, the stem should separate from the spur. Mm-hmm. You don't want to rip the spur off.
That's right. That's right. And then they ripen perfectly after that.
Yeah. And we'll talk more about this maybe in September with winter pears. And we're talking about summer pears now, or I don't know how you, a Bartlett. Mm-hmm. It's called a summer pear, maybe.
Yeah. Ubeline.
Yeah.
It would be an early summer pear. That might ripen by the time of our next show, even. Mm-hmm.
The winter pears benefit by undergoing cold storage. So harvest them the same way when they're unripe, but come off the tree easily. And I keep some in the crisper in my refrigerator. I don't have big green, greens. You have cold storage, do you not?
We have lots of cold storage,
yeah.
but we don't really put pears in it because we usually fill it with nursery stock.
Yeah, but you could. But
you could.
But I fill up a crisper or two in the fridge, and because I have a Anjou, and boy, it's just a treat to pull them out in November and December, and they'll ripen up within a couple of days.
Well, and it also reminds me of Anjou is a really big crop in Hood River.
Mm-hmm.
I have good friends who grow it there.
Yeah.
Lots of acres.
Yeah. So that's some tips there on harvesting figs, pears, and apples.
And even blueberries.
And blueberries, that's right.
That's right.
Well, it's, with blueberry, you just kind of pick whatever's blue.
Yep.
Or big, they do get bigger. When they're riper.
Mm-hmm. This year was interesting. My neighbor was telling me these berries are sort of on the small side. And I asked him why. He said it was the pollination when they were blooming was also during that cold rainy spell, and pollination wasn't as good as normal.
Did he bring bees over?
I think he has bees there. Yeah. But they weren't flying.
Right. Okay. Well, let's take our second musical break. We'll regroup and come back then with our new garden stumper. And we'll also talk about currants and gooseberries. Whew. And also curing onions, because that's time. Usually the end of August is when you can harvest and then cure onions, so you can get good storage on those. So our second selection is from Canned Heat. Now, does that have anything to do with the heat? Well, it's just hot, canned heat. And I think, isn't that slang for some kind of liquor? I should have researched that more. But what I did research was the tune that they covered. It's called Framed. And there's been quite a few versions of this, but I was shocked to hear that it's a Lieber and Stoller tune, and they wrote lots of hits in the 50s and 60s just as songwriting team, and I didn't write any other examples down, but they wrote this one in 1954, and it's we won't have time to listen to the whole thing, unfortunately, when the judge comes out, pours whiskey on his head, puts a reefer in his pocket, and says to the jury, "Convict that hippie, he's an addict." They kind of redid the lyrics from the 1950s. But so anyway, this guy got framed. It was originally recorded by the Coasters in 1958. That's going back a ways. That's even older than Jim. No, it's not. It's not even older than me. It's older than Joel. But just barely. It's the old fogey club here. So anyway, Canned Heat doing Framed.
I was walking down the street minding my own affair when two policemen grabbed me. I was unaware. Says, "Your name Bear?" I said, "Why, sure." "Well, then you the boy we've been looking for." "I got framed. Well, I was playing. Oh, it's the truth. I never do nothing wrong, but I always get framed. I get framed." He said, "Where was you on the night of June 29? "Well, I was home in bed." He said, "Jury, that hippie's lying. I knew I was a victim of some scoundrel's evil plan when a stool pigeon walked in and said, 'Oh, that's the man.' I was framed. Well, I was framed. Never do nothing wrong, but I always get framed. I get framed. Denied the charges of robbing that liquor store. Denied the charges of carrying a 44. Denied the charges of vagrancy too. But when the judge walked down, put a reefer in my pocket, poured whiskey on my head, turned around to the jury and said, convict that hippie, he's an addict. What could I do? I got framed. Oh, I was blamed, people. I'm going insane. Never do nothing wrong. But I always get framed. I get framed. I'm blown away,
Oh, we're going to have to miss the good part. That's what he says. Turn it up here a little bit, Joe. Turn it back up. Okay. All right. Well, that's a little nice little tune there, isn't that?
That's interesting. Never heard it before. It's cool.
Yeah, it's a nice arrangement of that one, too. The coaster's a little more, you know, middle of the road.
Yeah.
1958, that's what they had to do there.
Yeah, that was cool. Thanks.
Okay. Well, you know what time it is, Jim?
I can guess.
Okay, our pretty easy stumper, I mean, easy to explain here. And if you know the answer, you're the first person who can email the correct answer to us at thedirtbag@kboo.org. Pretty simple. Is what do blueberries and pure beeswax candles have in common? Jim's looking at me like, I have no idea. Okay, and Joe's pondering. Okay, so what do blueberries and pure beeswax candles have in common? The first person who can correctly answer the question will get a free sharpening of a hand tool at Coley Farm Store in Northeast Portland, Northeast 42nd and Alberta Street.
And if somebody can answer that question, they will deserve to get that free sharpening.
Well, it might take a little inside knowledge on this. I wouldn't be surprised if we don't get an answer. By the way, we didn't fully answer last month's Garden Stumper. It was a two-parter.
That's right.
Remember, it
That's
had to right. do with the rootstock names.
That's right. We got a correct answer for one part,
yes,
which was what the M in front of the rootstocks, like M7 and M26, mm-hmm. mean, which was mm-hmm. stood for Malling, which was the Malling Merton Research Station in England, where those came from. The second part of the question was the pear rootstocks that are indicated by a number and the letters OHXF. What does OHXF stand for?
Right.
And the answer is Old Home by Farmingdale.
What does that mean, Jim?
Well, yeah, it's Old Home is they're pear varieties.
Okay.
And they were crossed, and there was a whole research done. In fact, I was talking with this morning with my partner about this, that it was a cooperative effort between Oregon State and a nursery.
So kind of local.
Kind of local, yeah. And they worked to develop these different ones, and there's several numbered ones that have different vigor effects upon the variety, but they became the primary pear rootstock in the country, really.
And so the Old Home is one, and Farmingdale is the other, but they weren't necessarily local.
Just
at Oregon State.
That's right.
And
the breeding work was just done here.
Yeah, I use a lot of the 333.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And that 333 just signifies that was, you know, row three, number 33, or maybe the 333rd iteration of it.
Or something. Yeah. I mean, there's 97. I used to use when, I can't even remember it anymore, five something. There were lots of them. I mean, right. But of course indicates when plant breeding is we have discovered it ourselves here, it's really a long-term effort.
It's hit and mostly miss.
Boy. I mean, it's if you plant 1,000 something out and you get one thing, something that's good, you're doing well.
Yeah.
So it's definitely not something for people, for impatient folks.
Yeah. So when you say out loud the OHXF, Mm-hmm. You say X, you don't say bi or crossed or anything like that?
Well, that's what we say. I mean, it has a meaning. The X doesn't, that's what it's how it's written. So I just say OHXF. That's what we say in the trade typically.
Yeah. Okay. I've just been kind of curious about that my whole life.
Really?
I mean, how you actually delineate that from somebody just listening to us may think it was four capital letters. Mm-hmm. Letters.
It's a small X.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And if you were talking about the process or something, you could say Old Home by Farmingdale, would be another way to say it.
Yeah.
But when you're just saying it quickly do you have any pairs on that OHXF 333 rootstock?
Yeah.
People know what you're talking about.
Yeah. Well, some would.
That's true. But more now, though.
That's right. All of our listeners have been smarted up.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's get on to currants and gooseberries. You're growing some of those? I know they're, I think my currants are almost done.
Yeah. We were doing this about 4 or 5 days ago. We went down and did some sampling in our trial block looking for, there's several things we look for in those. And I got to say, currants are such an unsung hero of the plant world to me. I mean, when we used to do garden shows in our retail business, and I would hear somebody walk by with a European accent, I would go and tell them, hey, we have currants. And they would just be so excited and come over and buy plants from us because we had currants. And here in North America, people generally don't know what they are even. And when I was growing up...
Well, Jim, they don't know what current events are either, so...
It's spelled differently, Glenn.
I know, but they don't know either.
That's true. But, you probably remember growing up, there were these little red boxes of stuff that we would get occasionally called Zante currants. Z-A-N-T-E. I remember this as a kid. And those aren't currants. Those are dried raisins, small raisins. I don't know what Zante is. Maybe some listener knows Zante. But, I mean, currants were not something that we ate.
Yeah,
And even though some of our ancestors came from Europe and places, they must have forgotten currants in the long ocean passage because they're just not known here. But they're so delicious. I mean, a good currant. There are lots of different kinds. Some are tart. They all make great jam, and that's one of their main uses. But and the tart ones particularly good for that. But they're not very good for fresh eating. But there are some really good ones for fresh eating, and that's what we really have grown for years and try to I may pick some today or tomorrow because we want to pick them and put them in freeze them, eat them later.
You can buy dried currants and they're spendy, but they're called for a lot in cooking, dried currants and in some recipes, obviously.
I bet in a Swedish pancake, can you imagine fresh currants?
I could.
Oh, man.
In a sauce.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So we have currants. So the variety that we grew for a number of years, and this was sort of a trial and error one, and it's still one of our favorites, is called Blackdown. It's an old English variety. It does very well here, actually.
Yeah.
But there's other ones that we're experimenting with. The names escape me right now, some of the newest ones, but...
Oh, you mean like number 89 and number 430 or something?
Something like that. Yeah. It might be 90, but...
Okay.
But we're working on that one, and because there's a couple of other. I mean, for us, the disease resistance is important because they can get powdery mildew and some other things that make them look ugly and not happy. But to me, the yield and good flavor are very, very important. And that's what we're looking for. And then gooseberries, they're sort of in the same category. They ripen a little bit later than currants do. When we were sampling our currants, the gooseberries really weren't ripe yet, but they're probably by now. Here we are, July, end of July. But also a fruit that's not a berry that's not well known in North America, and sadly there were a couple of selections that were marketed for years that not very good. And so people that might have tried gooseberries and thought, oh man, that's not why would anybody want to grow that, but there are some really, really good ones, and we're working on those as well.
Well, it's too bad we aren't able to sample those.
Yeah.
It won't be ready. It'd be too late by September when we have our next live show.
I might be able to freeze a few.
Okay. Yeah, it'd be nice. Joe, are you familiar with... I probably had some, but no, Joe's...
Well, it's on the agenda to try to get some of those harvested before they fall off the plant.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, we can talk about them some more.
All righty. Well, the end of August also brings the onion harvest. And there are some steps that you should take if you want to preserve the onions, store them. So they'll last a half a year or more. I mean, oftentimes I'm still using the old onions when I'm planting the new ones. If you want storage onions, you should get a variety that's designed to be stored. And these would have more of a sulfur content. That's one of the differences between a storage onion and, for example, a Walla Walla, a sweet onion, or a Vidalia, that are known as sweet onions. They just don't have the sulfur content, so you eat them like an apple, although I never have. Jim? No. And they don't store very long, maybe a month or two, but then they'll start sprouting. And you can still use some of the outer peels of the onion, but plan to use those up on your salads and burgers or whatever else, those nice, fresh Walla Walla sweets. But for the storage onions, and some of my favorite varieties on those are Varsity and Copra. And oftentimes the books will say, you know, leave them out in the sun to dry. And I think that's risky. I've left particularly the red onions out, and they'll just scald. The sun will burn them, and then you'll have a burnt, unusable spot on the top of the onion. So what I recommend, and this is what I do, is I will stop watering maybe 2 to 4 weeks before I'm going to harvest. And the time for that is when maybe half of the stalks of your crop in your bed or whatever, wherever, falls over naturally. And if you have time, then you could go around, pardon me, and force the other's stalks over. Just kind of cuts the green growth off at that point.
How do you force them over?
Just bend them. Mm-hmm. You know,
you do it with a rake or
just by hand?
By hand.
Yeah, they're pretty wimpy. Mm-hmm. Some of them probably in your patch will have already started to grow a hard stalk, and then will eventually grow a scape at the top of that, or, you know, not unlike garlic, but it's, you don't normally eat them. And sometimes I'll just cut those off with my hand pruners and plan to use those up first, just because they don't store quite as well, I believe. So after 2 to 4 weeks in the ground, they should, well, I'd say if your soil is very loose, you could pull them up, but it might be better to loosen the roots with a garden fork or something like that. Just force, you know, the garden fork is usually they have 4 stiff tines that you can put into the ground with your foot, and just to lift the onion up gently. And because if you try to pull it out, you might rip off the neck, and leaving the onion in the ground, which would not be good for storage. The ideal is to leave all the stalk on the onion. Some books will say just leave them out in the garden for a while. I don't do that after I had this fiasco, you know, got hot sun and then, you know, destroyed part of my crop. So they're already dry because you've held off on the water, and then loosen them, pull them, and store them on a screen if you have it, or oftentimes what I use now are old strawberry boxes, just anything that you can have one layer thick. And then I store them on my front porch, which doesn't get any sunlight, but it gets good ventilation. And I'll leave those there for a month until I have time to deal with them. And you have to resist the temptation when you're going to take them off your front porch and put them elsewhere for storage, to clean up, so to speak, the onion. That is to say, you don't want to remove any of the husks if you can help it, that because leaving as many as possible will help the storage of those. And I essentially then, you could cut off the most of the stem, or the stalk, excuse me, leaving maybe 2 inches or something like that. You don't want to cut it way back towards the onion. And it'll be dried at this point, just papery. And then store them one layer thick on a just flat, someplace flat. And then I usually just keep them in my detached garage, which doesn't get heat. And if it's going to be very cold, that is to say inside the garage, you know, 25 or below 30, the outside temperature, maybe 25 or so, then I'll move them into my basement just temporarily and then move them back to the garage, the cool garage. And like I just reiterate, check occasionally, or of course you're going to be using them, but look for the ones that look like they're spoiling and use those first, of course. It's pretty fun to be able to go to the larder and pull out an onion then when you need it. You want a red or a yellow or a white?
Yeah. Okay, so. Yeah, that sounds great. I'm just anticipating that cheese sandwich with nice slices of onion.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's see here. We haven't talked about what's annoying us.
Mm.
Or it's annoying me. But this was my annoyance was validated or somewhat confirmed this morning. And I'll tell you what. I had another one that I was going to talk about. But I'll switch it around. Maybe I'll do two today, because it's Jim's going to.
I get one.
You get one on this. Okay, then we'll leave my other one for next month because it'll be the same. This one, my annoyance is very simply gates that don't work properly. That is to say, they don't latch. You got to lift up or something, or they don't even latch, no matter what you do. And on our And this was validated this morning when I was the first one that was going to go through the gate, and it had a lock on it. So I called Jim, and he gave me the combination. And this is a driveway gate, not a garden gate. I was initially referring to the garden gates, or just a gate around the house or whatever. And so the lock worked fine. That's a very nice lock, by the way. Mm-hmm. Very sturdy. The tumblers or whatever rotated nicely. And got it off and the gate, it's, I don't know how, 12 feet long or something like that. But it has a nice wheel on the end, so you didn't have to struggle to, it was tipping or something. No, it was hooked securely on both hinges, presumably, and it rolled nicely on the wheel. And so that's how gates are supposed to work.
This is a professional place out here, Glenn. So.
Yep.
Okay. Well, that's good. So my annoyance, I oftentimes don't join you in annoying things, but yesterday I was on a website trying to get a visa for Uzbekistan, which we have, my partner Lorraine and I are planning our first overseas trip and since the pandemic for the end of September, and to go to Uzbekistan where we have good friends, we need to have a visa. So we went on a site that I'd used some years before, and I don't know if they've changed the site or I just don't remember it, but what really bugged me about it was the faint type. And if there's anybody out there listening who has anything to do with web design, stop using faint type. I mean, I don't know why people make it, it's like, it's like, okay, I think there's words there. it's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
And some of the site wasn't that way. I mean, there were parts that were reasonably dark and you could read them, and then the parts that were just like all unintelligible. And anyway, it's been going on for a while.
Yeah.
That, mm-hmm. And I think, not everybody has eyesight of a 25-year-old. So I hope that somebody will realize that if you want to sell something or communicate something, make it readable.
Yes. And lest we come off as just, two old men kvetching. Yeah, I mean, these are things that people like us notice.
Yeah.
And you know, maybe you can go to another site, but anyway.
Yeah.
Okay, but on to gardening more. We have got a few minutes left here. And it's about time to get an update on the... one more thing here, our dirtbag dictionary term. Mm-hmm. Pretty easy and pretty short here. It's bolt or bolting, when a plant bolts. That simply means that it's going to seed. I think that maybe the clearest example, because many people grow or have grown lettuce, and hot weather tends to for plants to bolt. You'll see rhubarb sometimes they'll send a seed stalk up the middle. That's bolting.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And something that we talked about today already, it was bolting. Now I can't even remember.
Generally, bolting, certainly for lettuce, makes the lettuce not good.
Yes, right. I mean, bolting just means it's starting its seed production, and so there's other juices flowing there that makes it pretty bitter.
Yep.
Lettuce, in case of lettuce. So that's bolting. Yep. Okay, now in our last few minutes that we have here, Jim and Joe have been working on this documentary of Oregon's land use laws.
Yes, this is, you know, we've talked to us a little bit about this in the past, and just to kind of reiterate, Oregon, as many people who live here have probably noticed, when you're thinking about going to Junction City, for example, when you drive down the Willamette Valley, you drive from city to city, and the cities do not sprawl into the farmland. And every incorporated town in Oregon has an urban growth boundary which surrounds it, which says you cannot build outside that boundary without going through a process to get permission to do so. So that has really saved Oregon from the sprawl that our neighboring states have experienced, and it's allowed us to continue growing and have a really big agricultural economy here. So Joe and I, there's a 50th anniversary of a bill that was passed in 1973, coming at this anniversary next year, and it's called Senate Bill 100. It was really a groundbreaking measure, which sadly has not really been followed by any other state, but it worked in Oregon, and it was supported by so many cool people, and we've had the honor of interviewing a few people that are still with us from that time who were instrumental in getting that bill passed. And part of the bill subsequent to it were the setting of goals that were protecting farmland, protecting the coastline, encouraging citizen involvement, forestry. It's really a remarkable piece of work. And this is a very short story about a long story, but so as after it was passed, there were people who, of course, wanted to take it away, repeal it, and bring this back to like the free for all of everybody can subdivide their land and do whatever they want with it. And so those attempts were made for a number of years. They were all defeated until 2000, when a measure was passed by the voters called Measure 7, which would basically stated that if you had a regulation that didn't allow you to do development on your property, the reduced value, the government had to pay you for that reduced value, so to speak. And that was passed, and then it was struck down by the Supreme Court in Oregon because it didn't qualify. And then several years later, Measure 37 was passed, and I think there are enough people around to kind of remember what Measure 37 was about, and it was basically the same thing, but a statutory measure, so it wasn't subject to the requirements that Measure 7 was. And basically right around in our neighborhood, I mean, there were 300-unit subdivisions proposed. People were going to put up billboards everywhere that they could. Even in Portland, apartment houses were going to get built, you know, where they shouldn't be built. It was just crazy what was proposed. And thankfully, people became aware of it. They were sold this measure, but realized that, wow, this is not actually what what we want. We want to just have some fairness so that if somebody had a piece of property and they wanted to build another house on it for their children, they could do so. This was where people had owned that property for a number of years. Not to see Oregon become just a big subdivision, as far as you could see. So so the, again, the people came together, smart people and dedicated people and lots of farmers and so forth, like wanted to keep farming. And we got another measure on the ballot called Measure 49 that basically modified Measure 37 and changed that. So we saved Oregon, basically.
So is there going to be, you think your documentary will be ready by next year or for next year?
That's
next spring? That's your goal?
Yeah, that's
And is there going to be an official celebration of this 50th anniversary of it?
Well, there's people, lots of different organizations talking about that.
Okay.
But there's no concrete plans yet for it.
Okay.
But we will certainly let you and the listeners know.
Indeed. Okay. Well, thank you, Jim.
You're welcome, Glenn. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Jim and Joe, for doing that work. It'll be fun to see that. So, okay, we're out of time. Jim, thank you. Jim Gilbert and our ace engineer, sound production man, Joe Wilson of Bergman Productions.
And it's nice to see you all out here at the nursery, too.
Yes, so. Beautiful day.
Yeah.
In fact, I can see Mount Hood, which I hadn't noticed before. I can see that from here. This is Glenn Andreessen. We'll be back live in September. I don't know what day it is in September, the second Wednesday. Our last tune we'll go out on is, I'm not even sure who did this. It's just something I have. Maybe it's Sugar Blue, but it's called Pressure Cooking. Thanks for listening. Be well.